Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
I am well, thank you.
Happy New Year, Phil, and Happy New Year, everyone. How are you doing?
Yeah, I mustn't grumble.
Good, good. So, I assume we had a nice, I know you had a nice Christmas because we went out for a long walk and had a good chat. But today we're going to talk about retail because we've obviously coming out the Christmas period, we get lots of retail updates and absolutely dozens of retailers have reported or trading updates in the last couple of weeks. And we're going to talk about your Fantasy Sip, which has done extremely well over 2019. And we're going to talk about your new UK quality portfolio. Mm-hmm. Shall we start with the Fantasy Sip?
Okay.
Because this is something you put together. When was that? Sort of just before the end of 2018?
Well, this was my sip. This was actually a proper portfolio.
So you owned all these companies?
No, because obviously I made some changes over the last 12 months when it's been set up in fantasy form. But this was, I would say that the 21 shares in there, 16 of them were still in there now, were part of the portfolio.
But you must be gutted that you don't own them anymore because this portfolio has done extremely well.
It's cost me a lot of money. Yeah,
sorry about that, Phil. It's, you know, the rules are rules and
rules
all that.
Rules are rules. Rules are rules. I'm very happy to accept those rules.
Yeah. Why, incidentally?
Am I happy to accept
those
rules?
Yeah, why?
Because I think when you are a writer about companies, but you can look at this. You can look at this two ways. You can say it's actually better from the reader's perspective for the writer to have some skin in the game.
Yeah, skin in the game is always the argument for writers should own shares.
Yeah, and then you can have another view where actually it is better for the writer to be emotionally detached and impartial. And I prefer that.
Yeah, that were actually one of the great editors of the Investors Chronicle, Harold Wincott, that was always his view. He edited the Investors Chronicle for a very long time. That was his view.
I mean, I will say it has been compensated somewhat last year. I mean, from owning an S&P 500 exchange-traded fund, which done pretty well.
And that's what we, as writers on the IC, have to do.
Yeah.
We have to go down the sort of fund route, whether that's passives or open-ended funds or investment trusts, which is what most of our team do.
Yeah, and I knew all that before I joined.
Indeed.
So the decision, it's not something that's been, well, you know, that was the deal. It wasn't forced upon me, but that was the deal, and I accepted that. But I kept the portfolio running, and we've turned it into part of my weekly roundup.
Phil Oakley's Fantasy Sip, which did 31% in 2019.
Yeah.
And you benchmark that against lots of the other sort of funds that are taking a similar approach.
Yeah, so I'm sort of based, you know, very simply buying very good companies that can grow. Valuation is a consideration, but probably a third consideration to the first 2 points. What's often known in the trade as the sort of quality investing approach, or has become known as the quality investing approach, it's what I wrote my book about. And so I am essentially trying to eat my own cooking in terms of what I write about on a regular basis.
So that obviously means that you're then benchmarking yourself against some managers who take similar approaches, like Terry Smith at Fundsmith or Nick Train at Lindsay Train.
Yeah, a couple of investment trusts. So there's a Scottish mortgage one, there's a Midwind one.
It's mortgage quality? It's more a sort of growthy approach, isn't
it,
really?
Yeah, but it's been a very good fund to own.
Yeah, and a lot of our readers do.
Yeah.
I think it's the most popular investment trust amongst their readership.
There's like a Martin Currie Global Portfolio, which is again is very, and the Blue Whale one as well, which is, 15, 18 months old now, that fund's quite young, but it's that's a good fund. And then and it's compared against, an S&P 500 ETF from the FTSE All Share, because it does own American shares. One of the things I encourage, and I know it's something that you and I talk a lot about, and hopefully we will do a lot more of in the magazine, is encouraging people to cast their nets wider, and not just look at UK companies, but look at there are some wonderful companies listed on the US stock exchange.
Well, we did actually ask the question on this podcast, you know, should we be looking more at overseas companies? And I got some feedback, and the answer is yes. Yes, we should.
And we will, hopefully.
And, you know, the results of the Fantasy SIP in 2019 suggest that it's definitely something that's worth readers, investors doing. Although, having said that, the best performing share of 2019 in the Fantasy SIP was also the best performing share in our tip to the year.
Yeah.
The London Stock Exchange.
Yeah. Yeah, I think let's be frank here. There's been a bit of luck involved here. Don't get me wrong. I think the London Stock Exchange has got some fabulous characteristics in that there is they are incredibly difficult to compete against, and on top of that, you've got the theme of data with the FTSE Russell indices business. And obviously, the more passive investing you get, the more these exchanges are benchmarked against and the fees that you can take from them.
Mm.
And data, you know, it's a theme that I warm to as a long-term theme, that data is going to become more valuable. And companies that can take data and turn it into useful information for their customers, I think, are going to continue to do well. And I think the LSE is a play on that. And also the sort of, you know, quasi-monopoly type thing. You may not like that. But and I think that's only going to get better with this Refinitiv deal or Thomson Reuters in old money. I think that deal will come through, hopefully, in the middle of this year. And it's going to be good news for London Stock Exchange. I saw a very interesting article by, I think it was John Authors, Bloomberg, who said it was mentioning drew my attention to I forget the name of the fund, but the fund built a portfolio along the stock exchanges, or the great, you know, so, or the data providers, so LSE, MSCI, S&P, and it absolutely trounced the stock market. And I think because of this immense power that they have got. Now, if you're a customer of these companies, you don't like it very much, but if you're a shareholder, you do.
Having said that, you know, we are seeing, and you know, this data, these indices are powering a lot of the development of ETFs that we're seeing,
yeah.
And we've seen some data in the last week or so that's showing exactly the huge amount of money that's flowing into ETFs. I mean, it's absolutely vast. So, yeah. So you know, they are piggybacking that trend. And while that going is good, you know, the ETF providers, the product developers, they're not going to complain too much.
Not at the moment. I think there is a danger that the exchange providers push it a bit too much.
I do wonder. My understanding is one of the biggest costs of running an ETF is actually the cost of the benchmark that you're indexing against.
Yeah, I mean, I have a little bit of sort of experience and knowledge of this from my previous employment. And, you know, exchange fees are some of the annual price increases that can go on. Eye-watering.
We see it here because obviously we buy in a lot of data,
yeah.
And we provide some data through the website, through the, you know, investorschronicle.co.uk. And yeah, I mean, data costs, it's expensive. We spend a huge amount of money on this.
Yeah.
So you can see why.
And there isn't
it translates into a good business for the LSE and people like that. But yeah, it we question it every year. We're kind of stuck.
But
with
where's
it, though.
But you know, I was thinking, you know, one of the best ways to understand a business is to be a customer of it. So as a customer of the data, you know that there isn't a lot of choice.
We're stuck. There's nothing we can do.
Yeah.
But I do wonder whether things will change. I mean, you do have some people that are trying to develop sort of fringe indices, you know.
Bats, I think bats
being,
yeah,
yeah, the obvious, yeah, one. We've looked at that, but no one knows it. It's a branding thing as much as anything.
Yeah, It's the power of brand and you know, network effect almost now, because everybody uses it. The more people that use it, the more significant, the more relative, the more valuable it becomes.
So the LSE remains a pretty big chunk of the fantasy sip.
Yeah.
6.4%.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, your alpha report. What else have we got in there that you has done well this year and you're still confident in?
Avon Rubber.
Aha.
This is a business I've liked for a long time. Not a long time, but for a while or so. Because I think it's got some great characteristics. And one of the things I look for in really good businesses, which makes them extremely profitable, is that they are problem solvers. They solve a problem for somebody or something else. And Avon's big business is protection business. So its biggest thing is like breathing apparatus, masks for the US Department of Defense. And that is not an easy business to compete against, because obviously the Department of Defense have strict criteria. Not everyone can just sell in. So you have to be sort of an approved supplier. And Avon has been very, very good at working its relationship with the Department of Defense and developing new products over the years to keep on selling to them. And it's branched out into selling stuff to police, fire departments, mainly in America. And it's done incredibly well, spends a lot of money on research and development, developing new products, and it's just a very, very well-run business. And what's getting people excited is that it's bought a business from 3M, which is like a sort of ballistics business, which gets involved with all the sort of protection matters there. That's not going to start contributing to profits probably until sometime this year. The scope is, you know, we talked a couple of podcasts ago about acquisitions, about how companies that become really successful with acquisitions are the ones that have got a good underlying business as well. They're not using acquisitions to solve or mask a weak underlying business. They use it to turbocharge something that's already good. And I see Avon very much in this kind of mold.
It has the sort of feel of Helmer, which we talked about then,
yeah.
which is still 4.8% of the fantasy sip.
Again, Helmer is into this sort of protection analysis, very sort of, again, problem solving, almost sort of company critical or business critical type products and services, where there's a lot of trust and a lot of long-term relationships. And these businesses are very difficult to compete against. And the interesting thing about Avon Rubber is that, you know, you see it as a re-rating story on its valuation as well. And, you know, it went from being sort of mid to late teens price earnings multiple, PE, and we're now into the mid-20s. But we've seen Helmer go into sort of the early 30s on a PE basis.
Well, you've got Spirax Sarco Engineering there, which is a similar sort of story, and they're rated even more expensively.
Yeah.
So I guess what we're saying is a high rating, or might appear to be a high rating, isn't necessarily the end of that re-rating story.
I don't think you own it solely for re-rating. You have to have the earnings growth as well. And if it re-rates, great. But I think this whole thing of buying very good companies, because these companies are scarce, and this is not a view, this is actually backed up by looking at the evidence. History tells you, and I'm not saying history will repeat, but you can pay what might seem as very high multiples of earnings initially for these businesses. But over the long haul, you know, 5-10 years plus, they can develop into outstanding investments. And that's the hope.
Yeah, and you know, you've got some companies in here that you know, you might sort of question the quality, the competitive position. You know, companies like Sage, for example, or Croda, which didn't have a particular... I mean, Sage was okay. Croda didn't have a great year. Sage, you worry about the competition from someone like Intuit, maybe.
I'd be frank. You know, I'm keeping Sage because I think it's got some good intellectual property there, which either it's going to make good on or someone else might come and do it for them. You know, it's not massive. It's not a mega cap business. I mean, it's in the FTSE 100, but it's not that massive a mouthful for someone to come and do something with it.
I mean, it's probably, is it the biggest tech company in the UK? That would be Ocado now, possibly.
Yeah.
Tech company.
Yeah. But
we don't have a lot of tech in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, Sage has had a few, it's had a few difficult years. But, you know, the shares were up 27% last year.
Yeah, not bad at all.
If I was going to buy, if he was saying to me, which company would I rather own? Or, you know, I can only be impressed by QuickBooks. QuickBooks to me, which is the Intuit product.
Mm, it's a great product. And they're marketing it heavily in the UK.
And it just looks so easy to use. I've had a look at Sage, you know, a few years ago and I was doing some accounting courses. And I just found it really difficult to get to grips with. I thought, this is really quite hard. It's like you needed to know almost like a different kind of language. Now, I've not looked at it I've not looked at it as in depth since then. I've looked at the company, obviously, and I've looked at its product, and they are getting better. Sage are, I think they get this because they have to get it. Because if you look at QuickBooks, it just seems so easy for the user. And they get that message across. You see some of the adverts on the telly. You just think, yeah, this is great. Don't quite get that with Sage, but I think I think they'll get there.
I mean, Sage. My understanding is, my wife is an accountant. Yep. Is the choice of the kind of small accountancy practice in, you know, the regions, and there were lots of them because there were lots of small companies. But yeah, it requires some expertise to get to grips with it.
It's a skill. But I think to defend Sage. It's like sort of the old argument about, you know, like Microsoft Office. You know, it's if you have Sage deeply embedded within your financial systems, are you going to rip it out and replace it with QuickBooks?
I guess QuickBooks may be for the new entrepreneurs, the people who are setting up businesses now.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a position that is perhaps not as easily defended as someone like Halma or Avon or who knows? We'll see.
But I think, you know, Sage is still a play on a theme. It's a scarce asset. It's a problem-solving business.
Mm.
It does have a significant competitor, but it's still doing all right. And there's issues there, but I'm prepared to sit this one out.
All right.
Because I think what I didn't want to do is I didn't want to load this portfolio with American companies. I wanted some UK companies in it when it became a fantasy, because from our readers' perspective, I just didn't want to have a pure US fund.
Should we move on to the UK?
Yeah.
UK portfolio. Yeah. Now, Avon Rubber is a big constituent, in fact, the biggest constituent of that. Croda, which we haven't yet talked about, which was the worst performing company in the fantasy SIP, is in there too.
Yeah.
So I mean, we talked about Avon. Talk through the rationale behind the new UK quality portfolio, the difficulties you faced in putting it together, and why someone like Croda, which has had a difficult year, although not an appalling year, still features in that.
Yeah. So my sort of whole basis around this kind of approach is that one of the ways to win with an individual stock portfolio is cutting out the bad stuff. You try and focus on good businesses that are going to be resilient over a business cycle, you know, with the ups and downs of the economy. Because if you look at one of the things that determine long-term performance, not just earnings growth of a business, it's avoiding losers. And one of the best ways to avoid losers is to buy shares of good businesses. This is difficult in the UK, in my opinion, because the selection of really good businesses on offer, I think, is quite small. But even on top of that, the businesses that are very good are very richly priced. And so trying to adopt this kind of investment approach, you have to accept that you are going to have to pay up. But as I've just said, the evidence suggests that paying up for good stuff that can grow pays off.
Yeah,
and I think, absolutely. You know, just if you just look at that in the context of a real fund, and one of the best, you know, probably the best UK quality focus fund over the last 5-6 years is the UK Buffetology Fund run by Keith Ashworth Lord. It's had another good year in 2019, and he adopts this approach. He's written a book called Invest in the Best, and this has proven to be, you know, a very successful strategy for him. I know he has started buying some American companies in that fund, but it's still largely a UK fund, and it's proven that if you do buy really good businesses, even if the prices are high, if they are delivering, they can make for good investment returns. Now, the question of delivering, related to your last part of the question, to Croda. Croda is having a bit of a tough time in terms of its ability to grow. I still think this is part and parcel of long-term investing in companies, that you will get companies that you own will go through patches. You obviously hope that they don't, but they will go through patches where things get a bit tough. And, you know, profits are not collapsing at Croda. They're just struggling to grow. But the fundamentals of their business, I think, are still very good.
And it still fits into that problem-solving definition that you talk about quality companies having. I mean, it does, has specific advantages in specific niches, skincare, crop protection, that are hard to replicate.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it's still in your UK portfolio, and in fact, your Fantasy SIP as well. They're going to get through this little tough patch, in your opinion.
That's the hope.
Management might help them through that. Good management. And that's something that actually they have very much in common, I would hope, with Games Workshop, which you've written about in your magazine column this week, which, as you say, it's a story about good management and a little touch of operational gearing.
A touch.
A touch. A substantial amount of operational gearing.
Shed load of it.
Taking advantage of that is about good management. I'm a big fan of companies that are well managed. Hard to kind of ascertain that in when you're looking at a company, but especially when you're trying to predict how management are going to shape a company in the future. But Games Workshop have kind of, it's a case study in good management.
It is. I think the difficult bit with Games Workshop, obviously it's very wise with hindsight to see this. I think, you know, you look back at maybe 2014, 2015, this looked like a company that had lost its way. And, its customers were unhappy. The profits were stagnating, the sales were stagnating. And someone just come in and almost like they flicked a switch. And this company now is a real sweet spot. It has, it has a strategy and a business model and a business makeup that is just making lots of money. But this operational gearing, where the increases in profits are higher than the increases in sales, can work in reverse. And this is for me the big unknown with Games Workshop, in that everything looks really good at the moment, and I totally accept the view that there's a huge amount of potential still on Warhammer, which is its main fantasy game. Engaging over the internet, building the community, and G- getting these licensing deals to take the intellectual property into things like PC games, mobile apps, television programs.
But the royalty profits have, I mean, they've risen tenfold in, what, 5 years?
Yeah, and they're still going up. And there's, you know, there's the potential here to, you know, to have really, really big royalty. And these are virtually pure profit.
Yeah.
And what you've got, though, is you've got a very high fixed cost base in the business anyway. So this is
the cost of running the shops, the cost of factories producing the...
Yeah, designing, the staff, the plant in Wikuni, the manufacturing plant, the warehouses, that kind of thing.
But the marginal cost of producing an extra figure and selling it is tiny.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're seeing that in the results. You know, they're going to put their half-year results out, I think, next Tuesday. And, you know, based on the trading statement they gave in November, it looks like all the increase in turnover is dropping through to increase in profit. Now, the company is gearing up the business for growth, so it's added more manufacturing capacity. You've got new manufacturing capacity that's just coming on stream, or just come on stream, which is great if you fill it. If they fill this manufacturing, they utilize this capacity, then the profits of this business could be materially higher than they are now in 5 years' time.
Mm.
The issue is that by adding more overhead, you make the business even more operationally geared. And if you look at the history of Games Workshop, it has been quite a volatile revenue business. And so you have to sort of buy into the view that this is a secular growth story here.
When you say a volatile revenue business, I think the thing that you mentioned in the piece, which I must admit for what I had to cut out because we had to cut a few words, but actually it will be in the online version, is that it was kind of based around the release of new products.
Yeah.
So how are they overcoming that?
Yeah, it's about increasing the range of products, the frequency of products, the pricing.
New customers. And I think one of the things you mentioned in the piece that management did to broaden the appeal of Games Workshop was to actually kind of simplify a lot of what it was doing in terms of the games,
yes,
the entry-level products, the ability to play the games with the figures that it's producing.
Yes, so they simplified the Warhammer. They put a new release out, simplified the rules, made it easy for people to get up and running. And then they developed something called warhammercommunity.com, which is a community website. And this has been a phenomenal success in customer engagement. And, I mean, you say you cut out my article.
I didn't cut much out. It was just a tiny bit of paragraph.
I'm not being critical. I could have written a lot more on this. And what fascinates me about it, and, you know, it's an ongoing learning thing. And I was speaking to somebody yesterday, you know, who's got relations in the industry about it with another company. And it's getting behind the sort of the insight into the customer base. And it's this, you know, this is a great example of a company re-engaging and growing the engagement with its customers. And I still think there's a long way to go on this.
I mean, I'm looking at some of the numbers, particularly in terms of revenues here. And I mean, it's very well diversified geographically. America, obviously, the biggest market, as you would expect. UK, Europe, pretty strong. Asia looks tiny.
Yeah.
And that could be huge.
It could be, but I have a bit of a concern about intellectual property businesses going into certain parts of Asia.
Yeah.
And keeping the integrity of it. You know, if you're looking at miniatures, now, if you're trying to sell high-margin, highly-priced miniatures, you want to be tread very carefully in countries where perhaps the patents and designs on them are not respected as well as they are back home.
Mm, I think Donald Trump would have something to say about that. He's had lots to say this week, but we won't go into that.
And it's a common fear amongst many businesses that are selling these bespoke high margin products, maybe, you know, not just figurines, you know, it applies to engineering business.
Yeah, absolutely.
And their biggest fear is, you know, a cheap copy.
But this is part, I mean, going into much broader territory here, this is part of the kind of trade spat that is going on between the US and China is about intellectual property and intellectual property protection. So if that gets resolved in a way that's satisfactory to the West, then potentially it does change shift the dial again for someone like Games Workshop.
Yeah, and Games Workshop is an intellectual property business. That's what it is.
Mm.
I know it sounds a bit jargonistic. You know, some people say it's a toy soldier's business, but which it is in some ways, but it's much more than that. Really interesting article to write, actually. I really enjoyed writing it.
I like this company.
It's a fascinating business. There's some great, as I say, you know, the title of the article is A Case Study in Sound Management and Operational Gearing. I mean, it's just
it is online. I had to chop it in the mag as well because we were running out of space.
Yeah.
Sorry, Phil.
But yeah, so it's a company I continue to like. There are risks there, though. There's things to keep an eye on. And there's more in the article to read on that.
Well, there's a lot in the article to read on that. A fascinating business that I have loved since I was a child because I used to buy these things and paint them badly, as I think I've mentioned on this podcast before. What I do buy now a lot of, or would like to, is vegan steak slices. But unfortunately, when I went for lunch yesterday to try and get one, the queue for Greg's at St. Paul's was around the bloody block.
Yeah.
This is a business also in the UK quality portfolio. It's updated with some figures this week. I mean, it's just incredible what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, they have just... There's two things going on here from a revenue basis. One is the move, you know, this growing growth in, you know, meat-free products.
Is that really such a substantial part of their business? Or is it
no.
Is it PR?
No, but it's incremental. It's great PR.
I think that's what it really is.
It isn't. I'm not trying to dismiss that at all. It is a significant part of it.
Yeah.
But what it's done is it's given Greg's, you know, which used to be synonymous with sausage rolls and Cornish pasties and that kind of thing, to re-engage with a growing customer base and for people to know what fantastic value for money this company offers.
That is why I think there is a huge queue at Greg's at lunchtime in the city, because I think people, especially after Christmas, having spent a load of money, although, as we will come on to shortly when we talk about retail, not as much as the retail industry would have liked, I think people are looking for value for money. Go to Pret A Manger, go to some of the other food places up in London. It's extraordinarily expensive.
Yeah. And this is no secret with Greg's. You know, listeners and readers who know Greg's either as a customer or a shareholder, this company has offered fabulous value for money ever since it started.
Not very fashionable, though. Yeah, I mean, you know, there is when you go for lunch in London,
there is a bit of a
sort of fashion.
You go to Newcastle and Sheffield and Manchester and people tell you about.
Yeah, Greg's. But when you're in London, you know, you want to be you're judged by your food bag you're going back to in the office with. Oh. Greg's was never very fashionable.
I'll be very happy to have a Greg's bag.
Absolutely, but people increasingly are, because it's becoming sort of a fashionable story, and I think the PR around the vegan steak slice and sausage roll is helping that.
It's helping, but this is not just a story about meat-free products.
No,
there's been a lot of an ongoing improvement in the underlying quality of the business here, in that they are continuing to move the shops away from high streets where fewer people are visiting into places where more people are going, like railway stations, airports, service stations, university campuses, hospitals, a bit like WH Smith.
I was going to say just exactly that, which is also in the UK quality portfolio and the Fantasy Sip.
Yeah. And so you've just got a nice business here with two just, you know, very easy to identify growth drivers. There's a bit of issue on. There's a bit of issue about short-term cost pressure.
With pork.
Yeah.
Staffing.
Yeah, business rates, that kind of thing. This company's been very adept at managing them over the years, and I think there's still a long way to go on this one.
Yeah, no, I would tend to agree. Though we've moved it to a hold in the magazine.
Fair enough.
Run your winners, they say.
It's a view.
Yeah. It's a really interesting looking portfolio. And I'll leave listeners to, well, get onto Alpha and have a look at this. It's a lot of companies that you just look at and like.
Yes.
And actually, that's quite interesting, because the cover feature this week is about going out there and actually putting in some shoe leather and looking at companies and visiting them, like Greg's, and seeing if you like what you see. And actually, a lot of these companies fall into that category.
I would hope that not all of them, but a lot of them would fall into the category that they are quite easy to understand what they do.
And to get involved with. I mean, not Croda, not Spirex, but Smiths and Hollywood Bowl and Rightmove.
Yeah.
All the companies you can see exactly what they're up to,
yes,
as a customer. Should we talk briefly about UK retail? It's been a very busy week for UK retail. Greg's obviously had some good numbers. What else have we seen this week? So we've had a very mixed bag. We had the BRC, the British Retail Consortium,
this morning
saying it's been the worst year for retail in 25 years.
I think it's the first decline in retail sales for 25 since 1995.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, and obviously it seems to be creating more losers than winners. And we've had a lot of trading updates, and it paints a very, very clear picture as to what's really going on out there and how tough it is for a lot of high street names, and also, you know, the supermarkets. All the supermarkets have come out now, and basically there's no revenue growth.
It was a pretty shocking year for the supermarkets generally. I think Tesco was probably the pick of the bunch, really. I mean,
Tesco.
It was fairly pedestrian.
Only just getting it into positive territory, really.
But I mean, Sainsbury's struggled. Morrison struggled.
Sainsbury's did okay on food. It's Argos that's dragged it back.
Was the retail story?
Yeah, and I think Sainsbury's got a big problem now with Argos because it's. The cost savings of that business have seemed to either they've run out or they're going to run out pretty quickly. Mm. I don't know how that business grows its profits, really, which is why it was so desperate to merge with Asda.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to see where Sainsbury's goes from there. I don't think we've heard anything from them which has given any clarity on what they do next.
I don't. Yeah, this is a business, you know, like Marks and Spencer. Like, I would say, John Lewis, which is not quoted, but has released some financial news this morning. These businesses are in a very, very difficult position.
So we saw John Lewis, which is it's a bit of a UK bellwether in respect of sort of general merchandise sales, like-for-like sales down 2%.
Yeah, and profits falling a long way.
Waitrose doing okay. As you'd expect, but I mean, still flattish, just up a little bit.
Yeah.
Marks and Spencer's non-food down 1.7% on a like-for-like basis, food doing 1.4% growth. So, yeah, I mean, but this is a much smaller business.
These businesses have come to a point in the road where if they've not been had already, some very serious questions are going to have to be addressed.
Well, Marks and Spencer, we had an update recently. It was Capital Markets Day, and you know, it became very clear that a lot of the progress they'd promised just hadn't materialised. And so now everyone is looking, saying, okay, so what is going to happen now? And every update doesn't seem to bring anything.
I just don't know whether this business can be fixed at all. I mean, even on the food side, they seem to have bet a significant amount of money with this venture with Ocado. I've even seen, you know, talk of people even beginning to suggest that Marks and Spencers may try and buy out Ocado's UK grocery full stop.
Well, how would it pay for that? Another rights issue?
Another rights issue, yeah. or it divests, you know, it divests clothing or just
splits itself up.
Yes, breaks itself up, raises equity or whatever. And I'm not even sure that's going to work because let's face it, Ocado's hardly making huge amounts of money itself. And no one's making a lot of money from online grocery. But there have been some bright spots. And I think one of the continued bright spots in UK retail, and we've seen that this morning, is Dunelm.
Yes.
And they had a good year last year and they're up against quite tough comparisons, and they seem to be doing well again.
So here we've got like-for-like sales growth of 5%, gross margin up 110 basis points, but the qualification is most of the growth is coming online.
That's all right. You know, growth is growth.
Yeah.
But, you know, you would think that the online business, you know, providing they get the logistics side of it, and they, again, it's all about capacity utilization, keeps the profits. What you don't want, and you're not really, the stores business is actually still doing well. This is what makes you comfortable. It's not like Next, for example, where the online seems to be taking sales from the stores.
And everyone, I mean, Next had some numbers end of last week, or last week at some point. People were generally impressed with Next update.
I wasn't.
Well, you might not, but you're a hard man to impress, Phil.
I mean, this is the mentality that we've got into with retail, where it's people have moved away from looking at the direction of figures in absolute terms and actually asking themselves whether it was better or worse than what was expected. And yes, you know, Next full price sales performance was okay, but there's no profits growth in this business. And the only way that earnings per share are really growing is via share buybacks.
Mm.
Now, that's better than nothing, but it's not high quality earnings growth. And just so what seems to be the current theme is obviously the online business is doing well and the stores are losing sales. Dunelm seems to be at the moment in a position where both its online and its stores are still growing. But let's face it, Dunelm is coming from a long way back on online. You know, a few years, not so long ago, this business had a really negligible online business, so it's not really a surprise.
Also made a very hit and miss acquisition in this area, World Stores. It didn't really work.
No.
So everything went a bit wrong. And now it's, as you say, a question of recovery.
And I think it has benefited from, you know, the woes of businesses like Homebase, for example, which got itself into a mess and has scaled back. There's no doubt in my view that Dunelm has taken some business there.
I mean, one of the things we have seen from a lot of the retailers recently are complaints over the business rate environment. It's obviously one of the bigger costs of being a retailer that you alluded to earlier. We've got a budget coming up in March. Do you think they're going to get any help from the government here?
I wouldn't hold my breath. But there's no doubt that there's a lot of understandable requests to level the playing field up between bricks and mortar and the internet.
Yeah, I mean, the internet, I mean, obviously the company that dominates online sales is Amazon. In your fantasy sip, the great company. I mean, it's hurting. It's hurting the high street. And it's hurting, you know, as a competitor to some of the online guys as well. Sainsbury's bought Argos to defend against Amazon. Amazon might go into food retail. You know, if the government does actually have any intention of helping its own companies, you know, respond to the threat of Amazon, you know, it's got to do some of their business rates. It's not a good environment.
No, but it's something that has to be handled very carefully. If you've seen what's been going on in France, where the French government have been trying to slap sales-based taxes.
Oh, yes, yes.
On, you know, the likes of Google and so on. That's what people are asking for on, you know, the likes of Amazon in the UK.
Why not just do some business rate relief for bricks and mortar businesses? You don't have to tax Amazon anymore. There's some relief for store-based businesses. Who knows?
They need it. It's not going to get fixed quickly. It needs something bold, because it doesn't take a genius to look at, you know, these figures that have come out this week and the figures that have been coming out for a long time now. Things aren't really getting better here. And, you know, somebody pointed out on Twitter to me today, you know, this is a sector that employs a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, it pays a lot of wages. It pays a lot of tax.
We are a nation of shopkeepers.
Yeah, it's not just, you know, but it's supply chains, logistics companies, and it's, you know, the associated businesses around the high street that feed off all this activity.
Well, I mean, Greggs is on it. I mean, you know, whatever you say about Greggs moving into airports and you know, hospitals and universities, it's still on the high street. It's on my high street. The high street needs to be there for it to do well in those locations. I think government needs to look at this. But hey,
hopefully they will. If we look from an investing perspective, there are lean pickings in this sector.
Yeah, you found a few though. I mean, you got Smiths, we mentioned. This is not necessarily a UK story.
Not a high street story.
Not a high street story. JD Sports. A bit more of a high street story, although possibly more of a large Westfield style shopping centre story.
Yeah, international expansion story as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, JD Sports, Dunelm's doing okay. WH Smith on the sort of travel retail. I suppose you can bring SSP into that as well to consider people having a look at. But yeah, it's not easy.
No, absolutely. All right. Thank you very much, Phil. We're nearing the end of our allotted time in the studio. So anyway, that's great. We've covered a huge amount of ground there. As it happens, let me just talk you through what we've got in the rest of the magazine. As I say, lots and lots of updates from retailers. We've got some really interesting news this week. Aston Martin, Jesus. Phil's putting a face. Phil, you called this before it even came to market, that this was an accident waiting to happen.
All the signs were there.
The signs were there. We say it every week nearly. And the signs were there, and it's now... Well, got itself in an even bigger hole than it was in before.
Still been able to raise money, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, because but at what price? At what cost? I mean, it's eyeballing the price it's paying here.
If you were to own any, you'd rather own probably rather own the debt than the equity.
But absolutely,
you wouldn't sleep well owning either, I think.
Absolutely, the lead story this week of the magazine is Sirius Minerals, which is it's kind of potash producer hopefully potash producing mine up somewhere in Yorkshire, which. Has come to a head, couldn't raise the money through expensive debt even, and Anglo American has stepped in there to kind of take it out at what a lot of readers I know are saying is a very lowball price. Not sure what the alternative there might be worse, but have a read of that. We have a look at the oil market. Mark Robinson has written about what is potentially going to happen to the oil price as a result of the developments in the Middle East and the assassination of a leading Iranian political figure there. Lots in the personal finance and funds section, which they will talk about tomorrow. Algie Hall has gone through the tips of the week from 2019 and talks about... It's actually been an extraordinary performance given how many tips we write, which suggests that some of the changes we've made to how we come up with tip ideas are working, and Algie explains exactly what they are, what effect they've had, and how we're going to be developing those in the new year. John Barron has updated on his investment trust portfolio and how that's performed in 2019 very well. And as I say, the cover feature, How to Be a Share Sleuth, looks at actually getting out there, experiencing companies, and using that as another weapon in your arsenal of company analysis to put alongside the kind of numerical analysis that you do. He's looked actually in detail at JD Weatherspoon. I've gone out there, talked to suppliers, customers, publicans, anybody in the supply chain, and said what's known as the scuttlebutt method.
Yeah, it's a great piece.
It is a great piece, and it kind of it's really because you wrote about JD Weatherspoon, Phil, from the sort of. The numbers side of things, and this really is a really great complementary piece to that. Just goes to show there's value many different ways you can look at companies. This is great. Have a look. Anyway, thank you, Phil. Thank you all for listening. Happy New Year to everyone. Pick up the magazine, all good news agents. As I say, How to Be a Share Sleuth, Why Private Investors Need to Be Private Investigators, and we will be back again next week. Thank you.